panelists will be sharing with us this afternoon their experiences in being sponsored and sponsoring, how important it is in their sobriety, and how vital this is in seeing that the message of recovery is there for the alcoholic not yet born. I'd like to introduce our first panelist will be Lori F.
I'm Lori, an alcoholic. I'm back. I just keep showing up, you know what I mean? I was the victim of superb sponsorship. That's the reason I'm here today. And my sponsor was well sponsored. So my responsibility is to learn the best I can one day at a time how to carry the message. And I don't believe I can perfect it. And all I have is Lori's story. You know, I have to remember that. And for me, it works one-on-one. But I shared with you guys last night a lot about my sponsor and how I got my sponsor. And my sponsor is a book thumper. And she got me real acquainted with the books real fast. She said, you know, I kind of wanted a therapist. And, you know, I wanted somebody to, you know, give me therapy. You know, I didn't have therapy, so I wanted it. And she said, Lori, she said, this is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you want it, come get it, Baby Cakes. It's right here. And she opened up the page, and she would show me where things were at. And she said, don't take my word for nothing. Read it for yourself, you know? And, she got me involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would come over to her house and I would whine about what's going on in my life or, you know, what I was thinking and stuff like that. And she'd say, great, what are you doing? What are you doing, Lori? What are you doing? What do you mean, what am I doing? I'm thinking about it, you know. And to me, that was big, you know. And, you know, at least I wasn't drinking. I was thinking about it, you know. So, and it's just think, you know. And, but, I, you know, that was an excuse for me not to get into action. And, so she would pretty much rip all the covers off of me about that. You know, she would say, what are you doing? Are you in service? Are you chairing a meeting? And she was big on me giving my numbers to the newcomer. And I didn't like that, and because I had nothing to share. And but she would say, Lori, it's your responsibility. Even if, you know, maybe you have a month's sobriety or 2 months, you know, and what she said to me was, you know, maybe they can relate to you and they can't relate to me. And I couldn't understand that because I just thought she was wonderful. And, but, you know, what did ring a bell of truth with me is when I did get sober, my first couple of weeks in AA, I could not relate to anybody over 2 years. I didn't know what they were talking about. They were talking about emotional sobriety and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, all this stuff that I had, I didn't even have a clue. I just thought, oh, wow, they're off the rocker. But the people with 6 months, I mean, those people were, God, they had it. You know, they had something in their eyes, and I wanted it, you know. And so those were the attractions. So I knew that it kind of rang a bell of truth to me, like, okay. And I did everything under duress that my sponsor asked me to do. And I would go up to the newcomer after the meeting, you know, and she would say, every meeting you go to, you look for the person newer than you, and you give them your phone number. And I know what they're thinking. I know what they're thinking. They're saying, ew, you know, because I thought it, you know, that, oh, there's that little AAF, you know, and she's all excited about sobriety and blah, 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 and look at it, you know. And so I'd go up, you know, I'd say, hi, I'm Lori, I'm new, too, here's my number, you know. And, and nobody ever called. I thought all these people were going to call and, you know, ask all this great advice, and nobody ever called. But there was one girl that called. You know, I was in this exercise of doing this, you know, giving my number out, you know, every meeting. I had to look for that person newer than me. And I did go up to him after a meeting. I'd never seen this girl before. And I walked up and said, hi, I'm Lori, I'm new. Here's my number. And I never saw that girl again. And 6 months later, that girl called me up on the phone. And she said, I know you don't remember me, but I'm leaving for New York in 2 weeks, and I need to do a fifth step. And my sponsor told me that, you know, when I started sponsoring, you know, she was on my back about that. You know, you got to give it away to keep it, you know. I want it. I want what you have. I want 10 years of sobriety overnight. And she said, you don't get it by getting it. You get it by giving it away. And when I would leave her house, you know, after, like, you know, on Tuesday nights, you know, I'd go over there and we'd study the book, the steps, or, you know, whatever. And I'd say, oh, thank you, Dee. Oh, thank you. You've helped me so much. And she'd say, no, thank you. And I'd go, I don't get that. And she'd say, I know you don't get it, because you don't get it by getting it. You get it by giving it away. And so she said, you won't get it until it happens. And so now I know what she's talking about. You know, when the girls, when I get together with them in the car or at my house or after a meeting or whatever, I'm the one that gets it, you know, and I can't even believe it, you know, how that works, but it does. And I have to get out of myself long enough to just let, you know, just to share my experience. And so this girl and I, we got together in the park, and I'm telling you, I could not believe the things I was saying. You know, I could not believe it. I was impressed. And I just couldn't believe it. And she's like, how do you know all this stuff is that? I said, I don't know. And I was just finding all this stuff in the books, and, you know, and it was great. And we met for about, I don't know, like 3 times or, I don't know, 5 times on my lunch hour. And about a month ago, she called me up. I sent her a Christmas card about a year later, you know, and about a month ago, she called me up and said, I'm going to be in San Francisco, and can we meet? And it was really a gift. You know, she was still sober and connecting in AA back there. So it was like I just show up, you know. And my sponsor said, you know, every time I go over her house, you know, I'd get so much after the thing, and she'd say, and I'd say, God, you know, I just, you know, I'm not going to remember all this stuff. This is too overwhelming. I mean, it's wonderful, but I'm not going to remember all this stuff. And she said, don't worry. She said, your head, you know, your brain is like a little honeycomb, and, you know, God's going to place all that stuff in there. And then when you need to use it, you know, when a newcomer is placed before you and you need to use it, it'll all come out. And I'm like, you know, I got holes in the back of my honeycomb. And you know what? It's true. It's really true. When a newcomer is in front of me, it's like it just all comes up. I mean, things that I don't even remember, you know. It sure don't flow from up here, but but get me in the car with a newcomer or one-on-one, you know, and that's when it all happens. And my sponsor helped me a lot about personal relationships, and I had a lady at work that I had a personal conflict with early in sobriety, and I mean, really bad. This woman was a witch to me, and I would call her from my computer terminal, you know, my sponsor, and I would call her, and I'm working at a front desk, you know, and I'm like, oh, gee, you know, I need to borrow some of your serenity, and, you know, and there's tears, and people are walking by, and they're like, oh, what's wrong with her, you know, and if only they knew, you know, they know I'm an alcoholic trying to just, you know, survive in the world. And she would say things like, okay, the next day you need to bring Amelia a cup of coffee. I'm so sure, you know, and I cannot do that. And I had to do that the next morning. You know, I'd get up and Amelia would be sitting there, and you know, she had a lot of the characteristics that I do. She was real flighty. And, you know, just really, you know, all this kind of stuff, you know, and I didn't know that, you know, that I was reacting to that, but, you know, I would walk by her desk, and I would say, oh, I took every, oh, God, and I'd reach her, and I'd go, and she knew I hated her, you know, she knew it, I knew she knew it, and, you know, we were just, like that, you know, but yet, we were both smiling at each other, oh, you know, and I leaned over, and I said, Amelia, can I get you a cup of coffee? You know, and I was like, oh, gut wrenching, oh, stop, you know, and she goes, oh, yes, that would be wonderful, you know, and I just wanted to die, you know, and can I just like spit in there or something, you know, to go and get her a coffee, you know? I didn't do that, but I mean, that's what's going on in my mind, you know, and I come back, and I had to do that on a regular basis, and I don't know, about 6 months. And I'm, you know, I mean, give me a break. Give me a break, Dee. I'm chairing step study meetings. I don't know what I'm talking about. And she said, you need to chair that step study meeting. Oh, you know. I'm like, oh, you know. And so I'm chairing a step study meeting for 6 months. My home group, I had a year of sobriety, and my home group for 6 months suffered through me crying about this woman. And a few people today remember it. And they're like, oh, remember when you were chairing step study and you were crying for 6 months? I'm like, yeah, I remember. And, but what happened was, about 6 months after that, I'm still coming over to my sponsor's house, and I'm just flailing. You know, I'm just, you know, all I know how to do as an alcoholic is run. And I wanted to run, I wanted to quit, I wanted to move from Modesto, you know, get out, you know, things are going awry, and I want out. And I didn't run. And so finally, after 6 months, you know, I came over to her house one more time, and she said, Lori, you know, I believe that you truly have suffered enough. Maybe it is time that you quit this job or do whatever you have to do. And I'm like, thank God. You know, I needed permission from my sponsor to do anything. And so the next day I went in the bathroom, you know, and I got this newspaper out, and I'm looking at all the help wanted, you know. And what happened was I got grateful for my job and what I was getting paid for, and there was nothing out there. And I believe that I just hit a surrender or something, and I just, okay, this is the way it is. I'm staying in my job. And within 2 weeks, she was transferred, you know, to another position, you know. And I mean, you know, all this kind of stuff happened. And I mean, what I learned from that is I learned so much from that situation, and I learned what I will and won't put up with inside of me. And I also learned that, you know, my sponsor said, what's the worst thing that can happen? What's the worst thing that can happen? You know, and I thought, well, she could fire me. And you know, that's what I said to her. And she said, okay, big deal. You know, she fires you and blah, blah, blah. And you'll go get another job. You know, you can do it. Okay, but I came home, and I had a moment of honesty with myself. And I thought, you know, the really worst thing that could happen, I didn't tell her this, but the absolute worst thing that could happen is that she could walk into an AA meeting after I'd been slicing her up for 6 months. And I know what would happen. She'd come in, she'd be the new kid on the block, and she would get all this attention. Everybody would be going, oh, Lori, you know, she's not that bad, and I would die, you know. And for me, that was my beginning of looking at my self-centeredness, because, you know, trying to treat her as another alcoholic, you know, that I don't know what's going on in her life or whatever, but to have that same love and tolerance toward others that I have for you. Sure, I can come into an AA meeting all wide and bushy, oh, filled with AA love, and you're all so wonderful, you know, but taking it to the outside, it's a little different sometimes, especially when you have personality conflicts. My sponsor got me sponsoring women, and I did it under duress. I did it because she told me to, and I surely did not want to. She said that this is my Bible, question and answers on sponsorship, and I have to read that constantly because I have to remember. You know, it has so much valuable information in there about, you know, if the casual part, you know, can you be too casual in sponsorship or can you be too hard in sponsorship? And it says both ways work, you know, and both ways sometimes don't work, you know. And so I just have got to believe that there's a God that's working with us, you know. I have to believe that with white knuckles, you know. And a lot of times girls I sponsor, I know they want to treat me like a therapist, you know. Boy, am I the last thing from it, you know. I am just an AA member, and I just have to share my experience. And in here too, you know, what it tells me to do is introduce them to a lot of people so that they get a wide view of AA, you know. And so I do that, you know. I just because I cannot be all things. My sponsor told me that to me, and I cannot be all things to a person, you know, that they need, you know, a lot of different areas, you know. Different people have different gifts, you know. My husband's sponsor, husband and wife team, they taught me a lot about the newcomer and how important they are. And I try and get the newcomer involved. You know, how I learned about that is, you know, I don't necessarily learn so much by what you guys talk to me about it. I learn by how you act, you know, and you guys included me. You know, like, you taught me how to have fun in sobriety. You took me to plays, and you took me to shows, and you took me to AA conventions, and let me sleep on the floor, and you talked to me. And so what I try to do is that's just one time. You know, I believe sponsorship can just be one time, you know. I don't think it has to be this. You know, there's all different kinds of sponsorship, and I have to remember that because, you know, when I first started sponsoring, I thought it had to be just like my sponsor did, and I had to be just like my sponsor and tell them exactly the same thing, you know. And I do pretty much sponsor like my sponsor, you know, when it's like more formal, you know, like going through the steps and all that kind of stuff, but just sharing. But I believe you can just like sponsor after a meeting and just being there for another alcoholic, even if this is on a one-time basis, you know, just sharing yourself. And what I've also learned is in working with others in the Big Book, you know, I have to constantly study that literature because it's my, you know, it's the book, you know, and I can't get off on what I think, you know, about all this stuff. I have to go by what it says in the book, and all it says, you know, somebody told me, read that working with others, and all how many times it says in there that we're just here to be helpful, to be a friend, you know, and so that's what I just try and do, you know. I'm not the pull your covers kind of sponsor, and I've had a lot of pressure on myself. I put a lot of pressure on myself, thinking that I'm supposed to know this stuff, you know, like I'm supposed to be to like rip your guts out like they do in therapy and, you know, just go, you know, and there's lots of people that can do that. I just can't do that, and I need to be aware of that, you know. I'm just kind of like the more pokey little thing, let's go to a meeting, let's get in the car, you know, and that's just what I do, you know. So, I don't know. You know, I know I'm supposed to talk for a long time, but, you know, that's my experience, and I'm just going to stop and let these people have it. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Lori. I'd like to introduce our next panelist, Karen.
I'm Karen Garrison, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, I know of nothing that's been more powerful in my life than my sponsor. And I know of nobody that's been more instrumental in my sobriety than my sponsor, and probably more instrumental than anything that's ever gone on in my life, if you want to know the truth. And I come from strong sponsorship. It's beyond strong. It's beyond belief is what it is. And I'm not saying that everybody needs that. I know that I need that, and I'm real comfortable with that today, although at times in my sobriety I certainly have not been. And like I talked about this morning, I shared with the things that my sponsor told me he wanted me to do when I got sober. And for those that weren't here this morning, I'll run over those quickly. When I got drugged in my current sponsor after not doing well with 19 other sponsors in Nebraska, I found out that my way didn't work, and I knew that already, and I knew that this man was not going to put up with my crap for 1 minute. I knew that right off the bat, and that scared me, because I knew I could not manipulate this person, and I'm a master at manipulating people. I have been my entire life, and I knew that I had met my match, if you will, and I know today that on my best day and his worst, he could make mincemeat out of me. There's no doubt in my mind about that. And I found for the first time in my life a person that I cannot lie to. I've never even tried to lie to this man. And I think that those actions have saved my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. But anyway, he told me right off the bat, I want you to call me every day. I want you to read the book. And I want you to do what I tell you to do. And I don't want to argue with you. And he also threw in something else that I think is very, very important in my life. He said, I'm not going to compromise what I've come to believe in Alcoholics Anonymous for somebody that can't find their ass with both hands. And I understood that exactly what he was talking about. And I became willing to take those actions, and I became willing to want to get better in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started doing those things, and something real strange started happening, you guys. It was working. And I saw that it was working. I was feeling better. I was doing better. I was communicating with people better. And people were talking to me in AA in Lincoln, Nebraska one more time. And so I knew that this thing was working in my life, but I had no idea to what degree it was going to eventually work, I can tell you. And I love to tell two stories about my sponsor that they're so very, very precious to me. And I'll never forget that Clancy was coming to Kansas City, Missouri to give a talk, and I was about 3 years sober, and I've had several difficult areas in my sobriety. One was dressing like a tramp is what I used to dress like, and acting like one too. And I knew that I had to get something real nice to wear for this talk down there. It was going to be the first any kind of a big deal they had in Kansas City. And I was so proud to have him for my sponsor, and I wanted to look nice. And I went out, and I'll tell you, I spent $175 on this purple dress that was so purple it would have knocked your eyes out. I had purple fingernail polish on, purple shoes, purple nylons, purple eyeshadow, purple lipstick, purple everything. And just to top it off, I had a white hat on with a purple ribbon. And I thought that I looked nice. It wasn't that I was trying to look bad. I thought that I looked real, real nice. And I walked up to my sponsor at that meeting, and he looked at me, and he said, are you sick? Do you not feel well? And I thought, well, you know, what is he talking about? And he said, as soon as this meeting is over with tonight, I want to sit down and talk to you. And I thought, honest to God, you guys, I thought we were going to talk about how good I was doing, you know. And that's not what happened at all. And I sat down with my sponsor, and he said, why do you dress like a retired hooker? And, you know, that really hurt you guys. And I mean, that got me right in the guts, let me tell you. And I had not the foggiest clue of what he was talking about. And, you know, and very kindly, this man patted my hand. He didn't scream at me. He didn't yell at me. He said, you know, I love you, and I want you to get better in Alcoholics Anonymous. And do you see anybody else in this room dressed like you are? And I said, no. And he said, why can't you be part of instead of apart from? He said, I want you to start dressing like the rest of the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, I mean, I had tears rolling down my cheeks. That hurt so bad. But you know what? When somebody doesn't scream at you and yell at you, and you know that they care about you, I mean, I couldn't argue with it. I just literally couldn't argue with it. And I did what the man asked me to do and stuff. And I love to share that story. It's real funny now, but I can tell you it wasn't funny when it happened, you know. And I went back to my room that night, and I thought, I hate you, you old goat, you know. And I drove back to Lincoln, Nebraska. I threw all these tapes out the window. I it was just all over, you know. And about a little ways down the road driving back to Lincoln, I thought, now what did I do that for? Well, I love this man. Why did I do that? And I went back, and I'm sure I looked like a fool calling through the pastures in Kansas looking for his tapes, but I found all those tapes. And when I got back home, there was a message on my answering machine, and it was Clancy. He had beat me back to Los Angeles before I could drive back to Lincoln. And he said, I meant every word that I said. And, you know, and I know that you don't live in Los Angeles, but I know people that live in Lincoln, Nebraska that will tell me that if you don't do those things. So don't try. I meant every word that I said. And I think right then, ladies and gentlemen, I knew what I was dealing with. I mean, the game, there was no more game here. It was something I was going to have to do and be real about and stuff. And, you know, then Clancy encouraged me to get my nursing license back, and I did those things. And one more time, you know, I knew that this man was trying to help me. He wasn't trying to alienate me. He was trying to save my goddamn life, if you will. And I'll never forget, you know, when I was attempting to get that license back, and I would call Clancy, and I'd say, these people are treating me so bad. They're treating me like I'm a piece of crap. And he said, you know why they're treating you like a piece of crap? Because you are a piece of crap. He said, think about what you did. You know, people don't go around stealing drugs and stuff. You didn't, just exactly what you deserve. Now, you got to rise above that and do what they want you to do and get that license back. And I became okay with that because I knew that that man was supporting me. And then just to top it off, you guys, and I love to tell this story. It was time for me, for my hearing in Nebraska to get my license back. And I was terrified. I mean, I had put all my eggs in one basket, I can tell you. And I knew that I was just going to die if I didn't get that nursing license back. And I would talk with my sponsor on the phone and tell him how scared I was. And he said, you have nothing to be afraid of. You're either going to get it back or you aren't going to get back. But no matter what they say, you are going to walk through this with dignity and grace. That's what you're going to do. And if they tell you no, you will say to them, can I try again? And then you will try again. And the morning of my hearing, I talked to Clancy the day before on the telephone, and I said, I am so scared. And I was terrified. I don't know if anybody can identify with that kind of fear, but I couldn't even get out of bed in the morning. I was so scared. And the telephone rang about 10 o'clock in the morning in Lincoln, Nebraska. And I answered that telephone, and I almost didn't answer that phone. And thank God I did, because it was my sponsor. And he said, get out to the airport and pick me up. And I said, oh, are you at LAX or where? And he said, no, I'm not at LAX. I'm in Lincoln, Nebraska. And you'll never get that license back without me. Now get out here and pick me up because I'm hungry. And, you know, that's what I call having somebody out there for you, ladies and gentlemen. And I mean that. And what a beautiful day it was. And we went to that hearing and stuff. And I got my AA suit on and I jumped in my car that was full of crap, you know. And I thought, oh, this car is filthy and I'm just a mess here. And I went out and picked up my sponsor and we had lunch and stuff. Then we went to the nearest dumpster and cleaned my car out, you know. And we went to my hearing and stuff. And that hearing took about 15 seconds flat, you know. And but he was there for me. And those people were impressed, I need to tell you, you know. And I'll never forget that as long as I live. And I'll never forget what Clancy told me at the end of that hearing. He said, don't you dare tell anybody that I flew here because I don't want my image ruined, you know. And he said, you're going to pay me back for that plane ticket one of these days when you have the money to do it. And I tried to give my sponsor back that money many, many times. And you know what he told me? He said, you give it to somebody else that needs it. Now, that's what I call working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the way I've been taught to be in my sobriety and stuff. And just, you know, this and that. I mean, I got 100 stories I could tell you about sponsorship, but I don't think that they're that important tonight. I need to tell you what I have learned from sponsorship. And I have learned, and I'm not saying that everybody needs to be sponsored this way, because there's all kinds of ways of sponsoring people, but I don't know anything about that, you guys. I know about discipline, I know about hardcore sponsorship, and that's the way I've been brought up, and that's the way I continue to sponsor people. And when I get a new person in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sponsor a whole lot of women, I can tell you. And I can tell you those women, for the most part, are doing very, very well. I have very few problems with my babies because they're active members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want them to call me every day. I want them to read the book. I want them to sponsor people. I want them to take commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want them to go to AA on a daily basis, because those are the things that have saved my life. And I continue to go to Alcoholics Anonymous on a daily basis because I need to be there on a daily basis. And once again, I'm not saying that everybody should do that. I need to do it for my own comfort level. And those are the things that have saved my life totally. Talking to my sponsor about getting on my knees and praying for God's will has literally turned my life around. Literally turned my life around. And just on and on and on. So, I mean, you know, there's a lot of things I could stand up here and discuss with you today, and funny stories I could tell you. But I think that the main thing that I can tell you, and then I'm going to sit down, is that my sponsor loves me enough to tell me the truth. To tell me the truth. And, you know, I would rather have somebody dislike me in sponsorship and see that their life is saved than like me and watch them die from alcoholism, I can tell you. And I don't think that you can get in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think that I can have a friend for a sponsor. I'll tell you that Clancy is not my pal, I can tell you that. He is my friend, but he is not my pal. And because I don't think I'm going to tell a pal the truth, you know. And I get close to the people I sponsor. Sometimes I get too close, and I need to send them to other people that are going to be, you know, able to tell them what they need to do, because I find it painful to tell them, and then I think I'm doing somebody a terrible disservice, you guys, I really do. And that's been a real hard thing for me to learn, Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'll guarantee you one thing as I stand up here this afternoon, that my sponsor is not afraid of me, I will tell you that, and has never failed to give me the direction that I need to kick my rear end right down the road to recovery. So I'm glad to be here this weekend. I'm glad to be sober, and thank you for having me. Thanks.
Thank you, Karen. I'd like to introduce Jean D., please.
My name is Jean, and I, too, am an alcoholic. Sponsorship started with me in an institution. And as a direct result of the men and women on hospital and institutional work. And it started almost 40 years ago. At that time, I was frequenting, you can't call it a treatment program or therapy. They didn't have names like that in those days, you know. There was a big wrought iron gate out in front of this place, and it said, Illinois Asylum for the Insane. And that was in Elgin, Illinois, and I had been a regular tourist there in and out every winter, you know, and not warmer than being under the bridge. And they didn't have alcoholic programs or anything like that, you know. All the eggs got put in one basket, and that was it. You got treated as though you were mentally ill, and justifiably, I guess. But on Sunday night, them jackasses from AA would show up, you know. 9 or 10 wise asses from Chicago, you know. They come out there, you know, to conduct their AA meeting, you know. And we all had to go to the AA meeting, you know. That was part of the get you the hell off the ward routine, I guess. And being an alcoholic on a ward with a bunch of mentally ill people makes you sort of look good, you know. In other words, it's easy to look good in a nut house, you know. Competition isn't too tough, you know. And I certainly am not making mockery of those who are mentally ill, please understand that. But, you know, people like me and you need that kind of build up for our egos, you know. And a nut ward is an ideal place for an alcoholic to get it. Because I was the best ping pong player there, you know. And did you ever play ping pong with a guy who's on 400 milligrams of Thorazine? He's like this. And you're spiking them, yeah? Play pinochle with guys right out of electric shock, you know? Now, I was no different than a lot of alcoholics who come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a smart-ass, wise-ass, punk asshole who thought he knew all the answers. And I had a record in AA that wasn't too good. I had come here very early in my life, age 23, and for 6 years I tried to make a complete mockery of this program. And it took me 6 years to get my first year of sobriety. So during this period of time, I had gotten acquainted with members of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I knew these guys from Chicago. And unfortunately, or fortunately, they knew me. And the guy who was to become my sponsor was the head of that group. Use his name now, Bob Lambrick. He's gone to the bigger meetings, and I hated him. I hated that son of a bitch with a passion, you know. And I know now why I hated him, because he represented everything that I really wanted to be. And he was the living proof that I could be like that if I wanted to be like that. He used to come out to that meeting with a blue suit on, a white shirt, maroon tie, true cut silver hair, and looked like he'd just come back from a month on Miami Beach, you know. And he was the vice president of the locomotive division of General Motors. And I wanted to kill him. I wanted to kill him, you know, because he, just for what he represented. And so I've done the only thing that alcoholics can do, you know. I lied about him. We're pathological liars. And because we had to all go to the AA meeting, many of the people who went to the AA meeting weren't really alcoholics. They were mentally ill people. But I used to make them all come along with me because some jerks from Chicago would bring cookies and they'd bring loose cigarettes. You know, your values sort of change when you're doing a little time and Kool-Aid, you know, stuff like that. I used to tell the guys, you know, pick up the cigarettes, whether you smoke or not, pick up the cookies, you know, bring them back to the ward and give them to me, you know. And I was sort of in charge all the time, in charge, you know, and that, of course, was a big boost to my ego, you know, which always needed boosting, you know. Yours too, I guess, you know. I can always remember way back, one of the biggest honors I used to think that you could bestow upon an alcoholic would be by a bartender, you know, when they'd ask you to boil the eggs, or they'd give you one of them quarters with the fingernail polish on it and say, here, play three songs on the jukebox, you know. It was like saying, I really respect your judgment in music, you know. And on a network, you know, I was always put in charge, you know. And I'd lie to these guys. I'd say, don't listen to none of this bullshit you hear from these AA guys. I said, to tell you the truth, the reason they have to come out here to the meetings is because they're not allowed to go to meetings in Chicago. Because they still drink. Every one of these guys drinks, and I said, I know that for a fact. I said, as a matter of fact, they go to a saloon right after this meeting. I know the bartender down there. Lie like hell, you know. Lie. And that went on for 6 years. 6 years. And one night we were marching back to our ward, and I got this mentally ill all mixed in, and there's about three other alkies in the back of the pack. Guys that I just sort of knew from Skid Row or prison or something like that. No big bondage or anything, but... And I'm holding court, you know, don't listen to that whitehead son of a bitch. You didn't know a goddamn thing, you know. And all of a sudden from the back, and to this day I don't know who said it, one of these guys hollered out, hey, Duff, why don't you wise up? You've been lying like hell for 6 years, and that son of a bitch is out here every Sunday night trying to help us. He says, you're a phony son of a bitch. Now even they knew me. Even they knew me now. And I believe that the only importance to that event that day or that night was that it triggered just a little bit of a possibility that maybe you better listen. You know, maybe you better listen. And the next Sunday night, my life changed. My life changed. I don't really like to tell this, and I had no idea of even talking about it here today, because it's not a very pleasant thing. But it was the thing that I guess that had to bring me here, you know. We were sitting there at the break during this AA meeting on the ward. And I was sitting in sort of a couch like that. And right behind the couch, the AA guys from Chicago were standing around with coffee, shooting the shit, talking, you know. And they were talking about Robert Ripley, the believe it or not guy, you know. And I was sort of half listening, half not listening, you know, and picking up loose cigarettes and cookies. And they're talking about strange formations that Mother Nature had created. One guy said that he had seen a tree up in Maine someplace, that the foliage had come out in the exact shape of the old Indian head nickel. And another guy said he had seen a rock formation down in Sedona, Arizona, that was similar to the great Winchester Cathedral. And I listened. And then all of a sudden, the blue suit and the white shirt and the maroon tie, vice president of General Motors, says, "Well, you guys ain't going to believe this." He says, "But I saw a perfect figure eight cracked in a sewer tile." And man, my head went up like a rooster in a hen house, you know. What? And everybody said, "Ah, you couldn't see nothing like that." Now, maybe I should explain quickly how almost impossible that is. Sewer tile in the Middle West isn't made like out here in California. Out here, you make it out of concrete. In the Middle West, they make it out of clay. They bake it in big ovens, kilns. And it's very brittle. It's like glass. And big sewer tiles are usually 4 foot high and 36 inches across, you know. And to crack one of them, you know, into a figure eight, it'd be as impossible as me wrapping a piece of this glass window here and hitting it with a hammer, and instead of breaking it, would just crack it a figure eight. Now, I'm a stonemason by trade, so I know that that's impossible to do. But yet I had seen that figure eight. And when I looked up and saw this white-haired guy saying that, you know, I just bristled with resentment, you know. And I waited until after the meeting, and I sent my guys back to the ward all by themselves, and I went out to the parking lot to meet this jackass. And he came out there with his little box of AA crap and literature. And I said, "Hey, I said, I want to ask you something. I said, who told you about the figure eight?" And he looked at me and he said, "Why, did you see it?" And I said, "Yeah, but you didn't see it where I saw it." And then he put that shit-eating smirk on his face that them old-timers had when they know they got you. You know? But he said a word that changed my life. He said, "Rothschilds." Now, that won't mean nothing to anybody in here. Rothschilds is a scumbag, filthy pig hole on Chicago's Skid Row. Filthiest, scummiest saloon in the world, you know. And what's supposed to be a men's room or a restroom in Rothschilds is out the back door. You go out the back door, there's a little yard fenced in with all corrugated pieces of steel that they've stolen off of the roof of some building someplace and placed on end to make sort of a backyard. And down at the far end, a little ditch had been dug to be a trough. And up against that wall, they had taken some of these sewer tiles and split them right down the middle, top to the bottom, and then turned them two against the wall to resemble urinals. I don't know if this is how it happened, but the health department must have come around someday and made them put in disinfectant blocks. And they placed these disinfectant blocks about a foot above the trough. And that was the men's room in Rothschild's. I'd be a liar if I told you this is how it happened. But it's the only logical way that I know this could have happened. Public restrooms are great places for people to vent their anger and get rid of their frustration. It's not uncommon, you know, to walk into a restroom and find holes punched to the wall and the towel racks pulled off. I can only imagine that somebody went out there one day full of that anger, that frustration, and he wanted to break something. And wisely he looked around and said, "Well, I can't punch a hole in that corrugated steel. There's no towel racks in here." And all he saw was that little wire cage down at the bottom of that urinal. And due to the proximity of all the steel mills around Chicago's Skid Row, this might sound a little strange to you, most inhabitants of Chicago's Skid Row wear shoes that at those days were worth about $150 a pair. Because the steel companies used to give them out free. Because when the steel companies would come down in the morning to get day labor to get you out to the steel mills to work what they call the slag piles, which is nothing to get into, if you had these steel shoes on, it saved a lot of time. So they used to use it as a write-off for a donation, and then it would also save them time in putting guys to work. And I think somebody must have went in there to kick that wire cage off. And he missed it. And his steel-tipped shoe went right underneath the cage and struck that sewer tile in the perfect figure eight. Now, I want to repeat something so you'll be sure to understand what I have just told you. 4 foot sewer tile represents the urinal. The trough is at the bottom that passes the urine on out into the Chicago sewer system. The wire cage is about a foot above the trough. The cracked pile is under the wire cage. There's only one position you can be in order to see that crack. And I'm not proud of that. Your face has got to be in the trough. It wasn't such a startling revelation of mine to know that my face had been in that trough. What was startling to me was that the man I was looking at, the vice president of General Motors, with a white shirt and a maroon tie and a blue suit, had his face down there too. And I think that took away from me the last possible excuse I ever had to say that this program don't work. This program don't work. And that night I said something that I thought I would never say. That I would never say, and to this day I'm quite sure it was divinely guided. Because I said to this guy, Bob, would you be my sponsor? And I got all ready for the big hug. And he said, no. I was furious. After humbling myself to that depth, I wanted to kill him. I wanted to kill him. He has humiliated me. But before I could say anything, he said, the reason I said no, Duff, is because I want to tell you what it's going to be like if I'm your sponsor. And he says, and I want you to think it over for a week. And he says, I'll be back here next Sunday night, God willing. And he says, and ask me again if you care to. Well, I stood there with that talky AA shit, you know. I can handle anything you got, pal. What have you got, you know? And he says, if I become your sponsor, I'm going to make every decision in your life for the next year without any comment or question from you. Well, you know what I told him. You know what I told him. In no uncertain terms, I told him. But then I went and experienced the worst week of my life. Because I was in direct conflict with myself. I knew the truth. I knew I needed him. But yet I was trying valiantly to convince myself that I didn't. And every 10 minutes I'd go, screw that son of a bitch. What does he know? And say, yeah, but look where you are now, you know. Look where you've gotten yourself. I don't need that guy. All week long. The next Sunday night I went back then, I said them immortal words. Would you be my sponsor? And he said, yes, you know. And we sat in the parking lot until about 10 minutes to 4 in the morning. Talking about him. I think, for Christ's sake, I'm the guy that needs it. What are you talking about? And that's how it was going to be. I was very fortunate now. And I might say something now that's going to hurt some of you in here. I don't really give a shit, to tell you the truth. I've been around long enough now that I've outlived my critics. And it's just how I feel and how it was done with me, and that's what you asked for. You asked for me to tell you the truth, so I'm going to tell you the truth. Many of you in this room who know me know that I don't have an education, you know, that I can hardly read when I come through this program. I have no formal schooling or anything like that. So, and when you gave me that book, you know, that didn't mean anything. For a long time, I would hold the book at the meetings, you know, and if you'd say things, I'd make believe I was reading it, and I go, and I didn't even know what the hell you were talking about, you know, I didn't. But God was kind to me. God was kind to me. Because he put 3 men into my life. Bob, Ozzy, and Ray. Bob was to be my sponsor. But I might just as well say Ozzy and Ray were too. Because these men walked the words of the book Alcoholics Anonymous for me. I didn't have to read the words. I truly saw the words in action. Now, what I'm about to say now, I know, is a very common thing in AA today, and I'm not a judge, and I'm not a cop in AA. I don't like it. I certainly wouldn't do it to the few people that I sponsor. But I get uptight when I hear certain things. One of the things I hear a lot is people telling new people to go to 60 meetings in 60 days, or go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Bob, Ray, and Ozzy didn't say that to me. They said it this way. we are going to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. It is a firm belief of mine that you should never send a newcomer to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous unescorted. For God's sake, how the hell is he to know whether he's hearing right or wrong? Are you so great that you can't take him to that meeting? If you're too busy to take him to a meeting, you're too busy to be his sponsor. So leave him alone. He might be better off without you. And then this jackass saying that floats around this goddamn program by some imbeciles in this program. There are no musts on AA. Is that right? I'll show you in that book anytime you want it between now and tomorrow morning 57 times in that book where it says you must. Some say you had better, or when you're ready, or if you choose. It says must. So why the hell do they say that? And then why the hell don't people finish the sentences that they so lovingly like to exude? Don't make any major decisions for your first year. You've all heard that, right? You will make more decisions during your first year of sobriety than any other year in your sobriety. The step directs you to make a decision right off of the bat. The question should be carried to its fullest. Don't make any major decisions during your first year of sobriety without first consulting your sponsor or some other sober, knowledgeable member of this program. That's what it says. That's what it says. And we don't want to get into the sex for a year. I like to be around when you tell that to some newlywed. But these guys didn't do things like that to me. And Bob was a guy who didn't say too much. He never had to say too much. He could say in two words sometimes more than I could say in an hour. And discipline really is the key. Between the three of them, I had to go to a meeting every night of the week. And here's how they work. Here's how they work. I used to race harness horses years ago. And at Maywood Racetrack one year, I won an invitational race. It was sort of a big deal way back then, you know. And because I had gotten drunk and went off to a hospital someplace, I missed out on an award ceremony. And so a year later, you know, now I'm on AA, see. A year later, I get a letter from the Illinois Harness Racing Association that they're going to hold a ceremony at Maywood Racetrack, and they'd like to have me there to present me with this thing and all that. Oh, man, I'm ego sky high, all excited. Now, in Illinois, I have the, out here, you call them home groups. In Illinois, they call them your must meeting. You pick out one meeting a week, and only excuse for not being there is you die. You know, they accept no other excuse. And I think that was mentioned last night by you, where you have to have that discipline in there, you know. That's the meeting you go to. And they were going to have a ceremony on a Tuesday night, my must night. And Bob used to pick me up all the time because due to circumstances beyond my control, I wasn't allowed to drive for a few years. And I called up Bob this afternoon and I said, you won't have to pick me up Tuesday night. And he said, why? And I said, well, I got to go to Maywood Park and get an award for the Racing Association. My sponsor's favorite word was, huh? Huh meant everything, you know. Huh? Yeah. Then there was a moment of silence. And I'm waiting. He said, Duff, the next time you get drunk, call up a horse. And he hung up. And I know exactly what he meant, you know. My priorities can be turned around. And Ozzy, God bless Ozzy, because he taught me something that I have to be careful how I tell you this, and because I don't want some of you to jump right into this. It's just my belief. Ozzy was one of them grizzly old veterans in AA, you know. Tough son of a bitch, you know. And you never questioned anything that Ozzy said, you know. If Ozzy said the sky is yellow and violet, yes, Ozzy. And Ozzy used to pick me up on Friday nights, at Ozzy's meeting. Every Friday night, he'd blow that horn, I better be standing out there on the curb, and I'd go. Then this one Friday night after about 6 months, I'm sober now, maybe almost a year. It's in the fall. Ozzy comes by, blows the horn. I get in the car. Hi, Oz. Hi, Zup. Ozzy's driving away, and it takes a different turn. And I'm not going to ask him where he's going. Good God, he'd chop my head off. You know? I just figure he's going to pick somebody else up. You know. And he drove right out of town. He started driving in towards Chicago. I think, Jesus Christ, what the hell is going on here? And all of a sudden we went past the high school football field. And the lights were on. And Ozzy turns into the football field. Parks the car. He says, let's go. I says, where are we going? He says, the football game. I says, the football game? I says, what about the meeting? He says, screw the meeting. Of course, I'll explain that, you know, them wise old guys, you know. Ozzy was the first guy to tell me about returning to normalcy. He told me sobriety means you become normal, not fanatical. That you put normal things back into your life. Normal things. And Ozzy said he'd been going to high school football games for something like 30 years. And he wasn't going to miss this Friday night either. And I said, here I'm getting away from a meeting. What a joke that was. The section we sat in was about 15 guys from AA. So we had an AA meeting the first quarter, the second quarter, during the half, the third quarter, the fourth quarter. We went for pizza after the game, another meet. Instead of going to one meeting, I wound up at five. But what Ozzy was trying to say, and please, please understand what I'm saying. And this is how I believe. If all that my sobriety represented today was that five or six nights a week I was walking off to some church basement to drink that shitty coffee and eat them lousy cookies and listen to your bullshit over and over again, I'd be willing to take a chance at drinking again. You see, when I heard Bill Wilson in 1965 up there at the International Convention in Canada, that night in that hockey rink, he got out there and he told me what AA was, and that's what attracted to me. He didn't say AA was a place for losers. He didn't say AA was a place for people who can't drink. He didn't say AA was a tolerance program. He told us exactly what AA was. He said Alcoholics Anonymous is a program designed for people who seek a new way of life free of alcohol. That's what I wanted. A new way of life. I didn't stop drinking to stop living. I stopped drinking to start living. I wanted to go out and get my share of life. I wanted to be part of them. Football games or whatever the hell you want to call them. And he told me I could do that. And the only requirement for that was to try to practice these principles in all of my affairs. And these guys worked with me, not hard and diligently, but when I think now of the stupid things that they did, what I thought was stupid. If they hadn't done them, I'm sure I'd be dead today. Ray, you know what Ray said to me one night? At a meeting, I'm pissed off, you know. I'm saying, Jesus Christ, this is a drag. I have the Peggy Lee syndrome, you know. This is all there is, you know. And I said, you know, I said, we got to do something about starting the meeting so late. You guys, you know, if you're all married and all that, 8:30 is okay for you. I said, but geez, I get through with work. You know, I'm home at 4:30, clean up, shower, finish, eat my dinner, tidy up my apartment. I said, hell, it's only 7 o'clock. I said, wouldn't it be all right for me to go down to that saloon and, you know, just play shuffleboard with the guys for an hour or something like that, have a couple of 7-ups until the meeting starts? And nobody said nothing. They just shut up, you know, like, you stupid ass, you know. And after the meeting, Ray comes walking up to me. He says, is that laundromat still on the corner from where you live? I says, yeah. He says, start tomorrow. Wash your clothes every night after work. So what the hell is the matter with you, Washman? I said, I got more than one set of clothes. He says, wash them every night. So starting the next night, I went down there and washed my clothes I worked in that day. It took me a half an hour to wash them. It took me a half an hour to dry them. And I had to run like hell to get to the goddamn meeting on time. They had me on a Saturday morning folding towels in a beauty parlor. In a beauty parlor. For the women to put the things around their hair. Because I had said I had nothing to do on Saturday. So I finally learned, you know, I learned. But as Karen and Laurie said, that the giving it away is the biggest thing in the world. And I told a little story about San Quentin, you know, because when I came out here, I was the area chairman for hospital, area six chairman for hospital institutional work for many years. And San Quentin was one of our stops. And this, I think, brings out what sponsorship is all about and what giving of yourself is all about, you know. We went over to San Quentin on Thursday night. That's when we had the regular meeting. And any of you guys that are in H&I or been into the prisons know that nobody leaves the prison until a count is taken. Now, everybody's got to be accounted for before the outside guys can leave. And then once in a while, you don't get out till maybe 10 o'clock, 10:30. And this one particular night, two guys were missing. They couldn't find them. And it got to be almost 3 o'clock in the morning, and we're still in there waiting. And finally they found them. Two guys were passed out in the dairy barn over in the Tamal section of San Quentin, which is the minimum security part. And they passed out drunk. So they accounted for them, and then they discharged us, and we all left. So I had a new guy with me, a guy by the name of Cecil Covenu, who's dead now. And Cecil and I are driving back into San Francisco from San Quentin. And it's a foggy night, and it's a lousy night. And I used to drive a truck at that time for the Chronicle. And the tolls had gone up that day to 50 cents, and I was pissed off at that. And I'm pissed off I'm not going to get any breakfast, and I'm cold, and it's damp, and I'm ranting and raving, you know, and I'm giving it all hell. And I'm saying to Cecil, I'm sick and tired of coming over to this goddamn prison every Thursday night. There's a bunch of folks that coming over here. I said, guys get up there in a meeting, they walk around, they go get coffee. I said, better pay your goddamn bit of attention, Cecil. I hear shit, I don't think any son of a bitch has ever saved gold or run it down a bus here. And Cecil said, you did. Then it dawned on me. And I've been telling people all my career, I've been giving it away. Like hell, I have been taking every act that I commit to benefit another alcoholic is something that I need. I go to San Quentin to keep me sober. I work with new people to keep me sober. I speak in schools to keep me sober. I'm not responsible for anybody's sobriety out there, you know. And I had to learn that from a brand new guy. Another thing about sponsorship, you know, in the old green and white pamphlet, and I'm going to talk about this tomorrow. I used to think that sponsorship was the most important part of our program. And those were in the days when I used to try to single out the important things. In other words, trying to become an instant old-timer, you know. And I was led to believe by the green and white pamphlet, by the words, the old pamphlet, Questions and Answers on Sponsorship, it said something like this. Sponsorship is the heart of the AA approach to recovery. The heart. Well, there's no more vital organ than your heart. So the message that I was getting from that statement was, these guys were trying to tell me, sponsorship is the heart. That without the heart, you die. Without sponsorship, you die. So this had to be the most important part of the program. Well, of course, I've come to find out, as most of you, that there is no single part of this program that carries any higher degree of importance than another. This is just like a big automobile, you know. It takes all of the parts, you know. As far as running a car, the distributor cap is just as important as the brake. Carries as much importance as the spark plug. You need them all. And sponsorship, people always say, and it's a common thing to hear a new person say, well, I don't want to bother them. They're so busy, you know, and they got this and they got, you know. And he's such an advocate. Hey, Jesus, don't ever entertain them thoughts like that. It says right in that book, sponsorship is a two-edged sword. many times it has been proven over and over again that the older member needs the newer member far more than the newer member might need the older member at that time. You see, it's easy after, 30-odd years to forget what puke smells like. It's easy to forget the fear that you have in your third day of coming down, whether you're going to start seeing little blue beetles coming out of light sockets. And it's been a long time since you wondered about the paranoia of a divorce and all of that kind of crap. So you got to have that new guy feeding you that blood so that you know it and you never forget it. Because the day people like me and you forget that stuff, we're dead. We're dead. So we need sponsorship. Without sponsorship, truly, I believe we would die. Because the basic essence of this program is one alcoholic sharing his or her experience with another alcoholic. And if you allow me, just in a closing statement, I want to tell you what, in a very shrewd way, what sponsorship is. It's no big deal. Now, fortunately, in the situation that I'm in, I talk to new people on a daily basis. Lots of new people every day. And I have to explain these things. And the people I'm explaining them to are still full of denial, a lot of denial, or want it explained in simple terms. And here's how I explain sponsorship. I love the sea. I love the water. I'm a Scorpio. We love the water. We love the water. And I'm fascinated by ships. And it must have been fantastic in them old days of, iron men and wooden ships. And every time I go over to Golden Gate Bridge now, I like the ships are coming in. I like to look at them for a while. Biggest warship in the world is in Alameda right now. Biggest warship in the world. USS Carl Vinson. It's a nuclear aircraft carrier. And I'm just fascinated by these things. And I get fascinated by the men, who command these vessels. And I think of what it must have been in them old days, when them guys would go to sea, and they didn't have a hell of a lot to go by, They didn't have, next three exits to Honolulu or turn right to Wake Island, none of that shit, They get out there and shoot them little stars and stuff like that. And so to tell you what I think a sponsor is really like is probably right now there's a ship loading up in Olangapu in the Philippine Islands. Maybe its port of destination is Oakland Army Terminal. All right, it's that captain's job and responsibility to bring that ship from the Philippines to Oakland on the shortest, most economical route that he can get it there, the straightest line he can and the quickest. That's his job. And he's going to go out there and he's going to take that ship. Now, I don't know how wide the Pacific Ocean is. 7,000 miles, 8,000 miles, I don't know. But here this guy is going to take that ship, master of that ship, and he's going to bring it 8,000 miles. And sometimes it's so dark you can't see your hand in front of you out in the ocean. And then he's going to arrive at a point right outside the Golden Gate Bridge. Find out about the Farallon Islands. And a sort of a strange thing takes place. He throttles down that ship that he has taken 7,000 miles. And all of a sudden, a little launch-like vessel comes out from the bay. And the launch pulls up alongside of this huge ocean-going ship. Gang ladder is dropped over the side. And sort of a civilian-looking guy scurries up the ladder, goes immediately to the bridge and must show some kind of identification. And then the captain, the master of that ship, who has taken it 7,000 miles, turns complete control of that ship over to this new guy for the last mile. Why? And of course, most of you know who I'm talking about. I'm talking about the harbor pilot. The harbor pilot. And every major harbor has these pilots. Now, why do they have to have the pilot bring this ship in? Why can't that captain bring it in? Because it would be impossible for the captain of the ship to know every up-to-minute condition of that harbor. The harbor pilot would know. He'd know if any tides had shifted that night, if any piers had been on fire, if a ship had been berthed in the wrong place. He'd know every condition of that harbor. and he would be qualified to bring that ship in safely. And that's what a sponsor is. You have a sponsor not because you're stupid or dumb. You brought yourself a long, long way. Especially when you brought yourself to a point where you're willing to at least try. But for this last little push, you need somebody that knows the up-to-the-minute conditions about Alcoholics Anonymous. You need that guy to tell you whether you're going to the right meeting or to the wrong meeting. And it can happen, especially nowadays with the diversification of our groups. It can happen very, very easily. I know some macho guys that have, by error, have walked into gay group meetings, and their instant thought is, Alcoholics Anonymous is gay. And I've seen, unfortunately, by our own members, gay people bashed because they walked into the same wrong meeting, you know. So without guidance, we can get hurt pretty bad without guidance. So sponsorship is nothing more than the truest form of tough love that I know in Alcoholics Anonymous. And how do you know if you got a good sponsor? Very easily. He'll always be telling you things you don't want to hear. He'll be telling you to do things you don't want to do. And he'll be telling you to go to places you don't want to go. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gene. We'd like to open up to an open discussion. If anybody has any comments or would like to ask any of our panel members a question, we have a microphone there. Don't all rush up there. You can go to the microphone, because the reason we're going to the microphone is not going to amplify your voice, it's going to tape it. So speak loud, please.
My name is Jonah. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to ask Karen a question.
Karen, come on.
Someone before I had asked about this, and they said, because my question was, how come you have a man sponsor? Thank you. And I asked someone that before, and they said, because you were so dynamic that you needed another person as dynamic or even more dynamic than you. How do you feel about that?
How do I feel about having a man sponsor?
Yeah, and do you recommend it to other women and vice versa?
I have a sponsor that sponsors a number of women, you know, and I've noticed something about those women that he sponsors. They're intense people that perhaps won't listen to anybody but a man. I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that. But I know that, you know, I don't even defend it anymore. You know, I've had people tell me, you know, what are you doing with a man sponsor? You need a woman. And, you know, I would probably do very well with any number of women right now that I could name off the top of my head. But why would I want to change? You know, why would I want to do that? And all I know is that if the motives on both sides of sponsorship are good motives, that it works. And I know that the first woman in Alcoholics Anonymous didn't have a woman for a sponsor. There was no other woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that it worked, you know. But I also know the bad things about it, too. And I also know one thing. My sponsor's not interested in me, and I'm sure as hell not interested in him, you know, for a relationship type thing, you know. And I mean, I don't know what else to say about it. I know that it works because the motives are right on both sides, you know. But I don't defend it. I don't suggest that anybody else do it. You know, I just kind of hang neutral about it. All I know is that it's worked for me. You know, it's worked in a big way in my life. Does that help you at all? Okay, thank you.
Are there any other comments or questions?
Yeah, I'd like to ask Duffy.
Duffy, would you come up here?
About there's a lot of questions that I hear out there about the speed by which the newcomer should go through the steps, and whether the newcomer should have the right to decide at which level they move through the steps or the sponsor. Could you give a comment on that?
Sure. I said when I was talking that I was attracted by what Bill Wilson said, that Alcoholics Anonymous is a program designed for people to seek a new way of life. The steps are that new way of life. They're the suggestion of how to live this new way of life. There's no completion time on these steps. As a matter of fact, the people who've completed the steps are the people who are out there drunk right now. This is the way of life. These are the guidelines. Now, those steps could very well have been called a guide to living, a guide to living. I don't complete any steps. I retake steps over and over again. If you, in the 12 by 12, it tells you about all the different kinds of inventories we're supposed to take. The inventory we get here, the inventory each year, the spot check inventory. There are many times I have to remind myself that I'm an alcoholic today. And sometimes when I grab the reins back, I got to remind myself of the third step. So it's all in a course of my way of life now. So working the steps toward a completion goal is something I tell the guys that I sponsor never to get involved in. But if you want to put it on a time schedule, of course, I can only say how I do it, you know. I only sponsor my guys for a year. And I'll tell you why that is. Then I turn them over to other people. There's a lot of the things nowadays I don't really understand, you know. I don't understand about you need your space and that kind of shit, you know. And I'm on a downer. No, only fucking at you. But, you know, but if you were the guy and you called me up and all of that chicken shit stuff, you know, I'd say you get luck, you know. I know about you. You know, I don't know about your feelings and your relationship. I'm not saying that those aren't important things, but I just don't know. And thank God I'm smart enough not to try to make believe I know, because I could kill a lot of people doing that, you know. There's a lot of phonies running around in AA trying to play shrink and play counselors and all that, but I'm qualified to do it. So what I do is, after a year, I take my guys, I'll tell you exactly how it is if you're interested in me, which none of you could be because I don't believe in long-range sponsorship. But somebody asked me to be his sponsor, I tell him exactly what was told to me. You know, I'm going to make every decision in your life for the next year without any comment from you. And starting, and it's always ironically Tuesday night, you said, Tuesday night at my house, my three guys, well, none now because they're all sober a couple of years now, is step night. And each Tuesday night we go through a step. And we do that for 12 consecutive Tuesday nights. And then we go through the 12 traditions, and then when we finish the 12 traditions, we start at the 12 steps again, and then we go to the 12 traditions. At the end of that year, they've been through the steps twice, the traditions twice, and of course I insist that meanwhile they attend the step study group and the book study group. So by the end of the year, the men that I sponsor are pretty knowledgeable about the basics of Alcoholics Anonymous. And really that's all I know is the basics. I don't know the therapeutic part of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I don't really know how to solve all of your emotional needs and stuff like that. And I'm not going to screw you. Because screwing around with people's heads is a very dangerous thing to do. And it takes a lot of maturity to work with people. So you got to be awful careful. So don't try to become things you know that you're not. Just I stick with the book, you know, and it worked.
Does anybody else have a comment or a question? Okay. I'd like to read something. This is something out of the big book.
Excuse me.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see you.
My name's John. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to hear about how you're supposed to conduct yourself at listening to somebody's fifth step. I got a guy that just asked me to sponsor him, and he's ready for a fifth step. And I'm a little nervous about it. I don't know what to do.
Anybody like this?
You know, I find your question very interesting because I certainly felt the same way the first time I listened to this, Stephen. And I was scared. I really was. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to react. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and he said, you don't have to do anything. You sit there and you listen. And you listen. You listen for the deterioration of a human being going right down the toilet. You know, and you listen for, you know, the reasons that got them to Alcoholics Anonymous. You listen to all the crap that we do, to put it, you know, in short. And he said that, you know, that's all that you really can do is just be there for him. And he said, then he said, what I always do, and I did it with you, Karen, at the end of that fifth step, I always say, did you forget to put anything in there? You know, and undoubtedly most of us do, the one thing that we don't want them to know, and perhaps they'll tell you at that time, you know. And I know with my particular sponsor, he makes you get in the car and you take a ride up to Oxnard, California. It takes an hour to get up there, an hour to get back, and you read your inventory by flashlight. It's kind of a cute little thing that he does. because he thinks that people will share easier in the dark. They share easier when something's in motion. And, it was real easy for me to do that at that time, you know. And I remember at the end of that inventory, he said, "Now, have you forgotten to tell me anything?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "Tell me what you don't want me to know. You tell me every stinking rotten thing that you ever did. I want to hear about it in a general way. I don't want to hear your life history. Just tell me all the crap that you did. If you're a thief, you're a thief. You know, what all the stuff that you did." And I was able to do that, and I felt comfortable doing it. You know, if anybody can ever feel comfortable, you know, giving an inventory, I did. And I know with the people that I sponsor, I sit down and say, I want you just to tell me everything that you don't want me to hear. That's what I want to hear in an inventory. It's quite explanatory what that step says. We take a searching and fearless inventory and tell God, ourselves, and other human being the exact nature of our wrongs, and not our rights, our wrongs. And I got, you know, sober in a treatment center, and they want you also at that treatment center to make a list of your assets. And I asked Clancy, he said, "I don't want to hear about your goddamn assets. I want to hear about the crap that you did that got you to Alcoholics Anonymous." You know. And so that's all I know is the way I've been taught, and it's certainly worked for me. It's worked for the people that I sponsor. And it's a nerve-wracking thing when you're first starting to do it. I know that. You know. Now it's easier for me to sit down and listen to somebody, you know. And I can really, you know, it helps me more than it ever helps them. And that's the amazing thing. I see my life in motion, the things I was doing before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's just another, you know, stick in the fence of abyss, I guess, you know, that's going to keep me from that first drink. You know, so it's a valuable tool. Thank you.
My name is Dave, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dave.
Gene mentioned something about having the traditions as part of his sponsorship, or in sponsoring newcomers. And in talking with other people and in, you know, watching what goes on in AA and everything, I would like if Gene would expound a little bit more about the traditions, because I don't think sponsors, I know my sponsor has never talked to me in depth about the traditions. I have had myself to go to various service sponsors in order to talk about this. And I'd like to find out a little bit more about what Gene is talking about.
It's nothing more than the 12 steps and 12 traditions book. That's all I use. It's all right in there.
Anybody else have any comments?
Yeah, I'd like to know, my sponsor is beginning to tell me that it's time that I start learning how to sponsor people. And I'm wondering how a person knows when and how to do it, is what I'm getting at. If one of the panelists can tell me that, feeling comfortable with it. I felt comfortable doing my fifth step, but the sponsorship is kind of running into a brick wall with it. I'll do whatever my sponsor tells me to do, don't get me wrong, but I just need some help with that.
I guess the question is, when you become a sponsor? Anybody like to address that? That's like Lori.
Jeffy looked at me.
Don't cry.
I really hear what you're saying, and my sponsor told me that I had to place myself in a position to be helped. And she said the way you do that is that you give your numbers out to newcomers, and you don't know. You have to just be doing the stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous in order for God to work in your life. And I believe that God's running the show, you know, and it's nothing that I'm doing, you know. I mean, if I'm doing it, I'm in trouble, you know, but I have to place myself, and I have to be at the meetings. I have to be an active participant, you know, member of Alcoholics Anonymous in order for somebody to even see me. You know, they're not going to, you know, I'm not going to be home and they're going to call me and say, "Oh, God, what do you have?" So, and it didn't work like I thought it was going to work. I thought they were going to come up to me and want what I have and everything, and it doesn't work that way for me, you know. I just get them off the cuff, you know, and I don't know, I just think being active in AA and placing yourself, you know, doing the things like giving your numbers out, and I don't think you know when you're ready. I think God knows when you're ready. I think if you think you're ready, then there's something wrong. That's just been my experience. You know, it hasn't worked out. So I don't know if that answered your question. Did that help? Thanks.
I'm also not an alcoholic.
I will pray.
Up here in the mountains, sometimes people
okay. Up here in the mountains, sometimes I hear people say we don't have real strong AA like they have down in LA and stuff like that. And I've noticed that sometimes a newcomer will come into a meeting and they'll sort of sit on the edges and walk around and maybe come back and forth. And eventually someone will say, do you have a sponsor? And say, no, I haven't gotten around to that yet. And yet I know, or I suspect that someplace else there are traditions where we appoint temporary sponsors and we say, hey, this is your temporary sponsor. And I just had heard of this, and I haven't gotten experience of AA other than the mountains, but I remember there was about a 14-year-old that came into our group and was floating around. And, you know, I thought this kid was in high risk. And so I just called one of the gals over and I said, hey, up here we have a tradition and we appoint sponsors. No one had ever discussed this, not our board or anything. And I said, this lady will be your sponsor until you choose one. And at least there was a connection made there. And I just wonder, is this a tradition in some other places, and is it useful? And because I see so many floaters, that there's the resistance to, you know, making that big leap. And I see not just teenagers, but I see of people my age doing the same thing, and I'd like your comments on that.
Always remember, each group is autonomous. They can set up their own rules. You know, many, many groups throughout the AA land, appoint sponsors, and the steering committees of this group make up lists of people who are qualified to be a sponsor, not just pointing out anybody at the table. And so it works. The book also tells you that until you find a sponsor, to use the group as a sponsor. There's nothing wrong with that. Use the group as your sponsor. One thing you will always have to remember about sponsorship, and this is part of the last question of when you're ready to be a sponsor, you're ready to be a sponsor probably the first day that you stop drinking. You've got something to offer. But make sure you know what you've got to offer. If you've been sober one day, that's all you have to offer. How to stay sober for one day. Not how to stay sober for 10 years. You know what to do. And the book tells you all about these things. It says you can't give nothing to anybody that you haven't got yourself. Don't try to help other people because your own house is in order, you know. Walk like you talk. It's the same old cliches, you know. But anything that works is successful. And it's not a tradition, so don't get that mixed up with our 12 traditions. That's a group decision that let's have a bunch of people, because I give them telephone numbers and things like that, you know. But as soon as you can get a sponsor, we suggest that you get one as quick as you can.
Thank you. Hey, my name's TC. I'm an alcoholic. One area of sponsorship that I don't hear a lot about, and we all hear about recovery, sponsorship with a therapy, but after we started getting recovery and stuff like that, and then we get into service and stuff like that as our service sponsors, and I was wondering if we could hear something on service sponsors. I know I heard Duffy saying, like, when he was first getting sober or whatever, he in a sense had three sponsors that were following him, taking him everywhere. And primarily that was for recovery and stuff like that. They were also starting to probably put them into service and stuff, too.
Okay. Would someone like to comment on that?
I know that my sponsor took me to the traditions, too, and so she, implied the importance of it, you know, to become a part of the group and to become knowledgeable, to be responsible, to pass it on. And for me, when I got sponsored into general service just by somebody you know, telling me how attractive it was. God, Lord, you got to go to these assemblies and stuff like that. And when I went to these assemblies, then I heard the importance of a service sponsorship, and, you know, to get a service sponsor. So, I don't know. I don't know whether you're talking about general service, you know, sponsorship or service in general. I just feel like there's all kinds of areas of sponsorship, and I think a good sponsor will get you into service no matter what it is, whether it's service in the group or service in H&I or, you know, wherever it's at. I don't know. I think you'll just get what you ask for, you know. You see them, you know, usually they're pretty active in service. So for me, when I showed up at the assemblies, then I heard the importance of service sponsorship. And it's also in the sponsorship pamphlet, so I hope that helps. Thanks.
I'm a recovering alcoholic. My name is Larry.
Hi, Larry.
Duffy stood up there and started talking about three names. It's just by coincidence that my service sponsor in H&I also had those same three first names. And I didn't volunteer to go down to a L.A. County Hospital every Thursday night for almost 2 years. I was damn well told I'd better be there every Thursday night. There were about 25, 30 of us out of the Glendale area going to the L.A. County Hospital. And it is God's gift to me that I'm standing here alive today, and it was through service people helping me to get active in H&I work and at Chino, the state pen. It is by the grace of God that I'm here today sober. I live in General Service District 33. And I switched from H&I when I moved here from Southern California. And into action is, in my opinion, is the survival, is how I learned something through service sponsors here in this area. I'm exceedingly grateful to this panel today. I missed the first two speakers, but I did hear Karen today at noon. And I might say that her sponsor also was very helpful to me out on Ohio Street. And God damn it, that's the way this program works if we get into action. Thank you a lot.
Thank you. Does anybody else like to make a comment?
I'm Bob, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bob.
What I wanted to ask is, I mainly go to, I have my MUST meeting or my commitment meeting is a men's SAG meeting every Saturday, which oftentimes lasts 4 hours. And, but I don't make a lot of meetings, and I got a lot to learn from the women, but, I mean, you know, I guess I need, is that okay, you know? And same way with women, just to mainly to hang out at women's meetings. I mean, I feel comfortable with it, and we got a lot of guys from penitentiaries and that, and come in there, and I really relate to those guys, and it's been good for me, but hey, if you could comment on that.
What's your question, Bob?
Is it okay to like, I mainly go to men's SAG meetings, you know, I don't go around to women that much, and it's not a gay meeting until the guys I'm sitting with over here. But,
you got to go to a meeting you're comfortable at. That's where you go. You know, if you're comfortable at SAG meetings, that's it. Some people don't want to go to discussion-type meetings. Others just want to go to speaker-type meetings or women only. You know, you go away. I think, you know, I mentioned before, you know, 90 meetings in 90 days. You know, I was told this, so I don't really know if it's the absolute truth, that the basic reason that was first introduced was in the major cities, the 90 meetings in 90 days. And why they did that, they wanted the newcomer to be exposed to all the different kinds of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings that were in that city. In other words, it's just like when me and you would move into a new neighborhood, about the first Saturday you were off, you scouted the bars. You wanted to find out what bar you were going to be comfortable in, you know. where do they pour the biggest shot? Where do they play hard rock, country, western? Where will they hold my check? Who let me in the back door on election day? You had to go around to find out what place you're most comfortable in. And that's why they suggest 90 meetings in 90 days. They don't mean go to the same meeting 90 times in 90 days. Go out and experience one danger. No, I shouldn't say a danger. Opinion about diversification in meetings. I think we have to be careful. We have to be careful. In 1935, Alcoholics Anonymous was a unit, a group of men and women, and it worked. It worked. One of the greatest men in the history of our country was quoted as saying, "United we stand, divided we fall." Anybody with any military expertise knows the best way to destroy an enemy is to divide them, because then you make them weaker. 1935, we got one unit. I'm not saying this is wrong, but about 1940, somebody got up and said, and I don't know whether it was a man or a woman, somebody said, "Well, there's certain things that we want to discuss that you people wouldn't be interested in. Maybe we should have meetings for women only and men only." Fine. So the one became two. And that was all right. And then in 1946, some young punk, probably me, got up and said, "You old son of bitches don't know what the hell it's like out there. We gotta have a group where just us young people get to talk about." So we come up with young groups. Then the two became three. And then I don't know what particular order this happened. But all of a sudden the doctor said, "Well, we got problems you people don't understand. So we're going to have doctors-only groups. As a matter of fact, we'll have our own convention." Well, the lawyers weren't going to be outdone. So they said, "Well, we're going to do the same thing." Then the cops jumped in. Then the firemen jumped in. And then the priests jumped in. And then in the 70s, all of a sudden, gay population began to come out of the closet. We began to have gay groups, homosexual groups, masochist groups. At the rate that we are dividing our groups, in my opinion, by the year 2000, we will have 2 million groups of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each group will have one member. And he will be listening to his own bullshit, the very thing that got us all here in the first place.
I almost forgot what I wanted to ask after that. My name is Jim Muir. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hi, Jim.
I really like what I've heard Duffy say, especially about, you know, that bullshit about don't make any decisions in the first year of recovery. If I hadn't made any decisions in the first year of recovery yet, you know, I have to decide almost on a daily basis sometimes to pick up the phone and call my sponsor and get the help that I needed to stay sober, because shit was going on in life, and if you stop living, well, that's where I came from. You know. And I have a question about sponsorship. I sponsored a couple of guys briefly. I hope that they're still sober, but you know, Karen and Duffy especially talk about, and you guys are here to prove that you did what your sponsor suggested and what they told you you had to do. How do you handle somebody who doesn't want to do what you suggest that they do?
I love your question. I really do. You know, unfortunately, as sponsors, you know, we get people sometimes that, I guess, you know, in short, they're not ready for Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know, you know. But I know one thing, that, you know, my sponsor was emphatic right off the bat. You do what the hell I tell you to do, and if you're not interested in what I have to offer, then get the hell out of my face. I don't have time to listen to your bullshit. I really don't, you know. And that's it. It's been passed down to me. I'm in a group that believes that way. Every sponsor in that group believes that way, that we didn't come here to sit in our own crap. We need to get out of our crap, you know, and that's what these people have led me to believe, and I know that that's true. And I think I'm doing somebody a terrible disservice if I allow them to stand there and debate with me about what I believe in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, period. You know, and that's all I have to say about it. Does that answer your question? You do what the hell I tell you to do, or get out of my life. Find somebody else to listen to your crap. I don't have time for it, and I don't have time for it. Okay, and you know, and further, I want to say one more thing. I've said it before here. The people I sponsor are very, very active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they do what I want them to do, and it has turned their lives around. It's not because of me. It's because of the power of Alcoholics Anonymous has taken over their lives, period. You know, and that's why they're active, and that's why they don't cause me hardly any problems, although I'm ready to listen to their problems at any given time. And I give them an action, and if they don't want to take that action, then I don't want to hear about the problem again until they take it. You know, if it doesn't work, then we'll find something else that'll work. I've never had a phone call that said, it didn't work, Karen. Can we try something else? You know. My sponsor always tells these women I sponsor, if you don't like what Karen says, you come to Grandpa Clancy. He'll help you. And let me tell you, they just cut their own throat when they did it, you know, because he'll back up what I had to say because I believe what he believes. Thank you.
Any other comments?